from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Next on Forum this morning, historian Rashid Khalidi's latest book, Brokers of Deceit, examines the U.S. role in negotiating peace between the Palestinians and Israelis during three key periods. Khalidi argues that despite presenting itself as an honest broker, the U.S. was promoting Israel's interests and undermined opportunities to move the peace process forward. He joins us to discuss the book and this week's meetings between President Obama and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. That's next after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program, our second hour. Professor Rashid Khalidi joins us for this Forum hour. He is Edward Said Professor of Modern Arab Studies at Columbia University and the author of six books, including Palestinian Identity, Resurrecting Empire, The Iron Cage, and Sowing Crisis. His writing has appeared in the New York Times, Boston Globe, the LA Times, and the Chicago Tribune, and his most recent book is Brokers of Deceit, How the U.S. Has Undermined Peace in the Middle East. And welcome back to Forum, Rashid Khalidi. Good to have you.
It's a pleasure to be back.
I guess I'd like to begin, of course, there's much to talk about in your book, and I want to get into it, especially I think listeners will be interested to find out about declassified records and confidential documents that you had access to and the material that you marshal in this book. But first, talking about the meeting yesterday between Benjamin Netanyahu and Barack Obama, and you have been characteristic, I think it's fair to say, pessimistic about what's been called the peace process, and you even say that's a kind of Orwellian use of language, pessimistic where Palestinian rights are concerned. What about now, with President Obama essentially warning Prime Minister Netanyahu that there will be terrible international fallout if he doesn't endorse a framework for peace with justice for the Palestinians and recognition of the Palestinians' statehood, and that the International Criminal Court and a boycott campaign will be on his back?
Well, I think the devil is in the details, because the framework that very likely Netanyahu will accept will be one that will be essentially acceptable to Israel in terms of preserving all of the things that it has managed to preserve ever since the United States first got involved in this process in 1978 with the Camp David Accords. As I understand the framework that Secretary Kerry has been negotiating, it's all confidential, but this is what we hear from Israel, the Israeli press, Palestinian and Arab press, and other leaks. What the Secretary is talking about is continuation of Israeli occupation for an indefinite period. One of the most commonly mentioned terms is 10 more years, with the Israelis to supervise the Palestinians in that period, and with the decision on when that period ends to be in the hands of the Israelis. The United States had originally put forward the idea of an international force in the Jordan River Valley separating the Palestinians from the rest of the world, but that has apparently been vetoed. And so the framework as it stands does not include almost anything that would affect Israel's continued control indefinitely of the occupied territories. Obviously, at the end of 10 years, there's a slim possibility that they actually would withdraw. But on past practice, one can assume they'll just reopen negotiations in 10 years and say, yes, well, you haven't met this condition, you haven't met that condition. So essentially, the framework, even if Netanyahu does accept it and even if some parties leave his government or a party leaves his government, would be one which doesn't really change the status quo of absolute Israeli control over the entire territory between the Mediterranean and the Jordan. So it is not statehood. It is not sovereignty. Those are Orwellian uses of language designed to disguise the fact that really the United States is going to be, on the one hand, giving Israel or I should say giving Israel with one hand what it's supposedly taking back with the other.
So when you say, for example, as you do in your book, that the U.S. is in some ways even more unwilling to cede where Israel is concerned, that Israel in the past has been perhaps even more open to certain kinds of negotiations in the United States, which is Aaron David Miller, who's been on this program a number of times, calls Israel's lawyer.
Right.
The United States is in some ways maybe even a greater obstacle than Israel?
Well, I point out that a number of times in the past, Palestinian negotiators have found that the United States in making supposedly compromise proposals was even less forthcoming than the Israelis. That happened once when I was involved in negotiations in the early 90s, and it apparently happened during negotiations in the late 2000s under, I believe, President Bush, George W. Bush. So quite frequently you'll find that American presidents know that they have to do something, but they don't end up doing that thing that they know they should do. When push comes to shove, they end up taking a position which sometimes is, as I say in my book, sometimes more Israeli than the Israelis.
And your book also, as you have pointed out in op-eds, seems to suggest that the Israelis may never give up full sovereignty and they may never stop expanding settlements. And in fact, we had on Aluf Ben, who is editor-in-chief of Haaretz recently, and he said that there's essentially a plan to increase the number of settlers to 1 million that he was privy to, that I imagine you've been privy to as well in the occupied territories. Essentially you're saying that this is just all stalling for time and that's what it's been all about.
Well, that's what Israeli governments have been doing. I mean, one of the things that it's actually a graduate student of mine who discovered it in the Israel State Archives. One of the things that I foreground in my book is that this goes way back to the 70s when Begin was essentially stalling for time so as to complete the laying the foundations for the settlement enterprise that now has 600,000 Israeli citizens inside the occupied territories, illegally resident inside the occupied territories. And that stalling for time was something that Shamir publicly said he was trying to do when he left office. He said, I would have continued these negotiations for 10 years and planted a large number of settlers. And that's exactly the same policy that Netanyahu followed in every one of his prime ministerships. He is stalling for time so as to complete the incorporation into Israel of those large parts of the West Bank that Israel wants to keep permanently, and then leaving as sort of, you can call them Bantustan's reserves. You can't call them a state. You can't call them sovereign. You can't call them Palestinian. They're under complete Israeli security control, leaving for Palestinian, you know, municipal government those bits that Israel can't take over or doesn't want.
Well,
so yes, stalling for time is the principle of is the name of the game.
But I wonder, with a forthcoming visit by Abu Mazen, by Mohammed Abbas, on the 17th of March. He appears to be sincere about recognizing Israel's right to exist, not necessarily recognizing it in the sense perhaps that Israel wants to be recognized, but recognizing what have been described as legitimate security needs and so forth. But will Palestinians go along with that, I guess, would be another question from the other side. There's been kind of a isolation in terms of his role. He may even have a likely successor because of his age. And he's also got Hamas to be concerned about, as the Israelis do.
Well, Israeli security chiefs, the heads of the Shin Bet, the General Security Service in Israel, heads of the Mossad, the Foreign Intelligence Agency.
The gatekeepers, yes.
The gatekeepers would be the ones who are the heads of the Shabak, exactly, yeah. In that very good film. These three lots, as well as a lot of the military, have been trying to persuade the prime minister and his colleagues that they have an opportunity here that may not recur. To cut a deal. And they have been saying this almost publicly. It's interesting to watch Israeli politics, the way that stuff leaks and the way that people officials are able to actually exercise that kind of influence. But it seems to have had very little, if any, effect. This is a government that is still, I think, gripped by the idea of a greater Israel. Very much beholden to settlers and the settlement lobby. And it's, you know, there's a sort of occupation industrial complex in Israel. It's not just the 600,000 Israeli citizens who live inside illegally inside occupied Palestinian territories. There are many tens and hundreds of thousands of people whose livelihood depends on continued control over the Palestinians, continued expansion of the settlement enterprise and so on. So this government is beholden to that lot, and it's very difficult to see without much greater shock than this administration or any previous administration has been able to administer that course changing, which means continued control of the Palestinians, continued expansion of the settlement enterprise.
It seems, though, that the narratives have been changing. I mean, Ari Shavit's book has gotten a good deal of attention, and it's gotten a good deal of attention, I ought to add, and even the United States and the American Jewish community, and there is a good deal of sympathy for establishing a state in Israel, as I'm sure you're well aware. The problem, I suppose, gets down to security, and when and I know you've taken on this whole question again of the Orwellian use of security,
right?
And I understand that from the Palestinian point of view, but from the Israeli point of view, with rockets coming from Gaza, the notion that you hear not only from the right is often how can we give up more land when we saw what happened in Gaza with Hamas's takeover?
I mean, it starts from the very expression you use, how can we give up more land? The idea is it's theirs to give. The reason that there's resistance, the reason that there are rockets, the reason that there is a security issue is because they've smothered the Palestinian people for the entire modern history of the Palestinian people, expelling a majority of them in 1948, expelling more in 67, and preventing them from having self-determination. Again, if you start from the perspective that the Palestinians are inherently aggressive and they have to be held down, then you hold them down and then anything they do justifies that perspective. And that is essentially what Israel does. The security argument essentially says we have to force them to do things that will make us force them to do things. It's a circular argument which cannot possibly be countered logically. If they assume that Palestinians are inherently aggressive and hateful and so on and so forth. And to be frank, Shavit's book does not really undermine that very premise. It fully subscribes to the security myth, which is not to say that Israel doesn't have a security issue. It's to say that a large part of its security issue is created by its very policies. If you occupy and settle, you're going to have a problem. If you don't occupy and settle, you might be able to resolve the problem. But the people who say we have a security problem don't say, how do we get 600,000 Palestinians, 600,000 Israelis who've been strategically sighted so as to prevent the Palestinians from moving from place to place or ever having control over their lives out. That's never the discussion. I mean, what does planting Israelis in the middle of Palestinians have to do with Israeli security unless you assume that they are so nasty and hostile permanently, inveterately, that you have to hold them down forever, in which case don't justify it in terms of security. Say these are bad, evil people, these Arabs, and they don't ever deserve self-determination.
I mean, would hope that that's not what you're hearing. Maybe you're hearing more of an argument along the lines of Hezbollah and Hamas are dedicated to the destruction of Israel or against Israel's statehood. I mean, in fact, that is indeed, I think, the major argument that's given not only by Likud and the right wing in Israel, but even by those who are much more sympathetic to the Palestinian cause.
Well, Hezbollah has nothing to do with this discussion because they're off in Lebanon. I mean, they're a problem for Israel. And as I cite in the book, Ehud Barak, once prime minister of Israel, once defense minister of Israel, once chief of staff of the Israeli army, said that's a problem we created by our occupation of Lebanon. It was. But it's a separate problem from Hamas, and it's a separate problem from the Palestinians, linked but separate. No, what I'm arguing is against this security mantra that one constantly hears and which elides, ignores the fact that Israel has a security problem with the Palestinians because it's oppressed them for all of these generations.
So let me go back to your book here. And again, we're talking to Rashid Khalidi, author of Brokers of Deceit, How the U.S. Has Undermined Peace in the Middle East. Excuse me, I feel a sneeze. Cannot avoid a sneeze.
God bless you.
Thank you.
I thought it was on the East Coast that we had bad weather that's giving us all
cold. It's not the weather. It's just being on an airplane and being in that compact place where you can easily be exposed to colds. I get back to what you feel has been sort of misreckoned as the peace process, because in your book you really present this argument that the Madrid conference back in 1991 and the Oslo process in the 90s, as well as President Obama's peace initiative in 2009, were not only all about buying time for Israel, but buying time specifically to expand the settlements in the West Bank and to essentially sever East Jerusalem from Palestinians.
Well, that wasn't the American objective. I think that to give them credit, President George H.W. Bush and Secretary Baker, to a lesser extent, but also to some extent President Clinton and his secretaries of state and President Obama, started off, as I think did President Carter and even President Reagan, from the point of view that something had to be done to change the status quo and that this would involve a better deal for the Palestinians. The outcome was exactly as you said, because in the end it was Israel that showed unbending determination. And the United States, as I argue in the book, on this as unlike other issues, simply American policymakers simply didn't feel that this was enough in the American national interest to override the very powerful resistance that Israel and its supporters in the United States put up. I cite in several instances in the book, and I could talk about others right now, where policymakers have seen that an outcome is absolutely in the American national interest, that there are vital strategic or economic interests involved, and where Israel has been obliged by unceasing American pressure to cave in. This happened in the 60s. It happened in the 70s. It's happening over Iran right now. So it's not that Israel always gets its way. It is that on the Palestine issue, there's not seen to be a powerful enough national interest to overcome that resistance.
Well, what about Iran, since you brought it up? I mean, it remains what at least Benjamin Netanyahu has described as an existential threat to Israel. And we go back to Ahmadinejad's rhetoric. There has been certainly a change. Changing of the guard, but nevertheless, the concern out of Israel has not really been in concert with what the United States is doing by any means now, with what could almost be described as a kind of rapprochement with Iran.
Right. And I think that's a perfect example of where a vital American strategic interest is perceived by a wide segment of the American elite, the intelligence community, the top military brass, the politicians at the top of the executive, the president and his advisors. But incidentally, this happened in the second administration of George W. Bush, when Israel was pushing very, very hard to get weapons with which to launch a first strike on Iran, and Vice President Cheney supported that. And the same constellation of advisors and interests within our government went to President Bush and said to him, a war with Iran would follow, and on top of Afghanistan and Iraq, that's the last thing we need. And essentially, that's what the president's advisors have told President Obama. That this is folly, that Israel is not actually existentially threatened by Iran, whose capabilities are minimal, that if anybody existentially threatens anybody else, it's actually Israel, which has hundreds of nuclear weapons that could obliterate Iran. Iran has not got the capability significantly to harm Israel and probably won't for the foreseeable future. So our government has come to the conclusion that a war with Iran, which would be – is what would be required in order to deal with this nuclear issue is simply not a good idea, and that probably the nuclear thing is best dealt with via diplomacy in the hope that the whole issue can be resolved. It may or may not be resolved, but there has been a complete unwillingness to accede to the Israeli insistence that this is a vital strategic – sorry, that this is an existential threat and that the United States should align itself with Israel on this. The Israelis have all kinds of desiderata. They say no enrichment. The United States is not paying attention to that by the Iranians, various other things. And this is an example of how clearly when there's a major perceived national interest and a political interest on the part of the leaders in the United States, the president sees that war with Iran would not be popular. It would be a terrible legacy for his second term, that there's a perfectly clear willingness to take on the Israelis and just not to go along with them at all.
We're talking to Rashid Khalidi, professor of Arab Studies at Columbia University. He's the Edward Said Professor of Arab Studies and author of Brokers of Deceit, How the U.S. Has Undermined Peace in the Middle East. It's now out in paperback. He's also the editor of the Journal of Palestine Studies. And you are welcome to join this program. If you have questions or comments, we do welcome your involvement. Our toll-free number is available now. It's 866-733-6786. So feel free to join us again at that number. Again, toll-free, 866-733-6786. You can also email us. Our email address, forum@kqed.org, or you can post questions or comments immediately onto our website, which is kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. And you can also tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQED Forum. But we do welcome and invite your involvement and ask you about a couple of other kind of sidebar things, if I could, Rashid Khalidi. I was reading about a big flap that went on over an Orthodox Jewish high school in Manhattan that had invited you to be a speaker and then essentially disinvited you. And there was a petition by students. They wanted to hear what you had to say. There was also John Judas of the New Republic, who was invited and then disinvited to a Museum of Jewish Heritage. A lot of this gets down to questions about just how open, let's say, American Jewish organizations are, or schools for that matter, to what are perceived as anti-Israel screeds or positions. And I'd like to get your take on it, particularly in light of the fact that a lot of the Jewish press says that Jewish Americans seem to be open to competing narratives and condemn those who are unopen as bigots and close-minded and so forth. But try to invite, let's say, a pro-Israel point of view to, say, an anti-Israel or a Muslim school or something along those lines, and you would meet even greater resistance. Get some thoughts from you on that.
Well, I'm not sure what the reaction would be if you invited someone who is pro-Israel. We're inundated with pro-Israel views in this society. It's very hard to get away from them. The media reflects them very, very strongly, and our political system is almost impervious to any view that's not pro-Israel. So it's very difficult to get away from those views in our culture. I mean, I haven't got very much to say about this. I find it interesting that such a large proportion of the students at this school seem to feel strongly about this, about my being allowed to speak there. I think it speaks well of them. I mean, the argument that I'm pro this or anti that, of course, has a lot to do with my public persona. But my writings and what I would have been talking about at the school are an attempt to delineate, as I understand it, on the basis of my reading of the documents, the history. And it's something that, you know, if students feel they need to have access to it, they probably should have access to it. I mean, it's none of my business how a private school runs its affairs. But when you get to universities, the idea is that everybody should have access to any range of views that they wish to have access to. The last thing I want to say is that there is a, I think, quite pernicious move to ban speakers simply because they're associated correctly or incorrectly with this or that position. The same thing happened to my colleague Judith Butler, who teaches at UC Berkeley but is a visiting professor here at Columbia, when she was banned from speaking, I believe it was on Kafka, simply because she was described as being in favor of the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement. And I think that that kind of censorship and, in effect, boycotting boycotters is really counterproductive, and in fact is a violation of the First Amendment, especially when it's done by government.
We are coming up on a break here.
State legislatures and so forth. Sorry.
We're coming up on a break here. I just want to get in one more question because I want to go to listeners when we return, and that is you mentioned the word access, and it reminded me of the fact that when President Obama was first elected, there was a lot of talk, particularly from the right and maybe one might say from the pro-Israel community, about friendship between you and President Obama and how you would influence President Obama's thinking. I mean, they said the same thing, of course, about Bill Ayers and a host of other people. But do you have access to the president? Do you consider him someone that you have access to?
I have had no access to the president since well before he was elected. And I think that the brouhaha was partly intended to make me radioactive, such that the kind of advice that I or Charles Friedman or Robert Malley or other people who were talked about as potential policy advisors would be seen as beyond the pale. And it succeeded. Malley finally has gotten a job 5 years into the administration's life, but not working on Palestine-Israel issues. Charles Freeman, who was nominated as head of the President National Advisory Council, never did get that position. And so I think that this is part of the sort of savaging, the sort of pit bull savaging of people who are seen as, you know, outside the very narrow limits of what can be said.
We'll talk more with Rashid Khalidi, and we'll hear from you when we return his new book, Brokers of Deceit, How the U.S. Has Undermined Peace in the Middle East. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Historian and professor Rashid Khalidi is with us this hour. He's professor of Arab Studies at Columbia and author of Brokers of Deceit, How the U.S. Has Undermined Peace in the Middle East. It's out in paperback. He's also editor of the Journal of Palestine Studies. And in his book, he examines the U.S. role in negotiating peace between the Palestinians and Israelis during three key periods and argues that despite presenting itself as an honest broker, the U.S. was promoting Israel's interests and undermined opportunities to move the peace process forward. We're talking about his book. We're also talking about this week's meetings between President Obama and Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu. And you are welcome to join the program at our toll-free number, 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org. And Rashid Khalidi, here's an email from Sherry, who asks the following. Thomas Friedman, reporting from Beirut in the New York Times on June 9, 1982, described you as, quote, a director of the Palestinian press agency, WAFA, which was the PLO's news agency. And during those years, the PLO was listed by the State Department as a designated foreign terrorist organization. I'm not going to ask how you are able to teach unbiased courses on the Israeli-Arab conflict, but I would like to know your take on what the Palestinian Liberation Organization was formed to liberate, since the organization formed in 1964, before there were settlements, before there was any occupation, etc.
Two quick things. The director of the Palestine News Agency was a man named Ziad Abdel Fattah, not me. So
Friedman got
Tom
it wrong.
Friedman. Well, you can talk to Tom about that. Secondly, the Palestine Liberation Organization was established in 1964, before the occupation of 1967, before there were settlements, but after over half of the Palestinian population of what was then Mandatory Palestine and became Israel were expelled. So it was a reaction to the dispossession of a majority of Palestinians from their homes and their homeland, and the refusal of Israel to allow them to return or to ever get access to their property. So it was an attempt to respond to a great injustice that was done to the Palestinians back in 1948, long before the 67 occupation.
And we go right to our callers. Reinhardt, you're up first here. Welcome to Forum. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks. Dr. Khalidi, I was just wondering, in terms of in the mid-2000s, when Ariel Sharon withdrew the 10,000 settlers from the Gaza Strip, there seemed to be a pretty deep political fallout within Israeli politics. Even in a best-case scenario, with a moderate or left-leaning Israeli government willing to compromise and withdraw settlers from places like Hebron or East Jerusalem, do you think that's even something that could happen politically within Israel? Or would there just be too much of a potential fallout from that?
There actually was not that much of a reaction to Sharon's removal of all the settlers from the Gaza Strip. It was done pretty much against his own political base. It helped the breakup of the Likud party, but it nevertheless did not cause the enormous furor, nor did the removal of settlers from Yamit in northeastern Sinai after the Egyptian-Israeli peace treaty. The right has built up the idea of you can't move these settlers, and has masked what a lot of polls done by reputable Israeli institutions have shown, that a very large proportion of the settlers are there essentially for economic reasons. And if the enormous subsidies and inducements that the state has flooded them with over many decades were removed and were applied elsewhere, as the Rabin government began to do in the 1990s, a lot of those people, and certainly not all of them, maybe not even most of them, but a very large proportion of people who are in the settlements essentially for economic reasons could be induced to move elsewhere. Rabin switched a lot of subsidies to road building inside Israel to underdeveloped parts of the Jewish sector of the country, areas like the south and the north, and built up a lot of support for the idea that the settlements were sucking funds away from very serious needs inside Israeli society. If you had a political leader who were willing to do that, that's not Netanyahu. I mean, Netanyahu is a child of a Likud worldview, of a Greater Land of Israel worldview, which sees these as territories that should be settled and colonized by Jews and belong to the Jewish people only. But if you were to have a leader who was willing to do that, it would certainly break down the myth that all the settlers cannot be removed. Some of them would move willingly, remove the subsidies and apply them elsewhere, and you would see a very large number of them move very quickly.
It's fairly – and let me thank Reinhardt for the call – fairly safe to say at this point, as many have, that Netanyahu is in the position where perhaps Nixon was with going to China. He could actually politically now make a serious move toward establishing Palestinian statehood and do it without necessarily having the concern or anxiety over the consequences.
Well, that's what these various security chiefs, current and retired, are trying to persuade him to do, apparently without success. Henry Siegman just had a piece that I think was released yesterday in which he said Netanyahu simply hasn't changed his spots. He still has insisted on Israeli control in perpetuity of these territories. He doesn't say in perpetuity. He says 10 years renewable or 10 years, then we'll look at it again. And unlimited expansion of the existing settlements. So I don't know that this is a Nixon to take Israel to China. In fact, I'm pretty sure that Benjamin Netanyahu is not that person.
Let me bring some more of our callers on. Adrian joins us. Adrian, you're on the air.
Hi, Professor. I have a question regarding what I believe Ed Said came up with at the end of his life. Is there any legitimate thought about establishing a single binational state as a resolution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict?
Well, you know, both of these ideas, the idea of two states side by side and the idea of one state, have some really serious obstacles. I mean, the problem with two states is how do you reverse the dynamic that has been underway since 1967 to incorporate these territories and settle them with Israelis? And it's not just 600,000 people. It's where they've been placed systematically so as to interrupt the contiguity of the central and northern and southern parts of the West Bank, split the West Bank off from the Jordan River, separate Jerusalem off from the rest of the West Bank and so on. How you reverse that and get two states, how you connect the Gaza Strip and the West Bank and so on and so forth. So there are enormous obstacles to a two-state solution, most important of which is reversing a dynamic that has been almost irreversible since 1967. The obstacles to an equitable one-state solution are numerous as well. One of them is that there's an international consensus in favor of Israel. Not so much in favor of Palestine, though that's what the United Nations voted for in 1947, a Jewish state and an Arab state. But the only state that was created and the only state the international community has really paid much attention to or has much interest in is the Israeli state. And that is a very important – it's not just international legitimacy. There's an international consensus around this. It's not just the United States or the United States in Europe. And how you overcome that is the first thing. The second thing is – the Israelis want to have their own state. And the third thing is a lot of Palestinians who have never enjoyed self-determination, never enjoyed sovereignty, never enjoyed statehood would also like to have their own state. And given the hostility that's developed between the two peoples, you'd have to a lot to overcome. The last thing is – and I have to end with this. We actually have a one-state solution now. It's an inequitable, a terribly unfair solution in which one group has absolute rights. They can bring their relatives in from anywhere they want. Another group does not have those rights. Israeli citizens who happen to be Palestinians can't marry a Palestinian from somewhere else outside of Israel and give that person citizenship. Arabs inside Israel cannot have access to, let alone own, a very large proportion of the land, which used to be Arab-owned before 1948 because it belongs to the Jewish National Fund and is inalienable trust of the Jewish people. So you have all kinds of levels of discrimination within that state.
Well, but Israelis can't marry Gentiles. I mean, you know, there's 1.2 Palestinians.
They can go to Cyprus and do that.
Yeah, no,
they
I know that. But there's all – you were talking about, you know, the force of religion in a Jewish state. But you've got 1.2 million Palestinian Arabs who, as Israel keeps saying, are fully invested with citizenship rights, even though the Palestinian argument is that they're second or third class citizens.
It's not a Palestinian argument. I mean, the levels of poverty, the way in which they're blocked from advancement in all kinds of spheres are incontrovertible. They are in many, many ways second class citizens. Israel is defined as a state of the Jewish people, so that all kinds of things that go with being Jewish, Palestinian Arab citizens of Israel, born in Israel, whose ancestors were always in Palestine, are not eligible for a variety of rights. But they are the lucky ones because, as you say, they are citizens. They can vote. They have access to health care, welfare, and so on and so forth, even if they're discriminated against. It's the Palestinians who live in other parts of the territory under the absolute control of Israel, which is the only sovereign power between the Mediterranean and the Jordan, who have real problems, as well as that majority of Palestinians who live outside of historic Palestine, outside of the area controlled by Israel in the occupied territories.
I will go to emails in a moment, but let me go to some more of your calls first. Gregory joins us from up in Santa Rosa. Gregory, you're on the air. Good morning.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for this program. I have a question that's outside the box, which is, and I have no love for Israel at all, and I don't really know that much of the Palestinians, but why, if the Palestinians want to be a sovereign people, why don't they act like a sovereign people and just forget about Israel, establish a constitution, declare their independence and sovereignty, and send diplomats out to the world to be recognized as an independent state?
A little of that has some of that has occurred incrementally with the United
Exactly.
Nations.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. The problem is that the entire territory that they claim for their state is under foreign occupation. That's, say, the occupation of the state of Israel. So you can proclaim anything you want. The Palestinians have actually proclaimed their independence a couple of times, once in 1988 when they had no territory at all, and the PLO, which issued this proclamation, was in exile. And since then, and that statehood has been recognized by the United Nations General Assembly. And that and 5 cents won't get you a cup of coffee, as the saying goes, in the sense that it doesn't change the status quo on the ground, which is that the entire territory that the Palestinians claim, East Jerusalem, the West Bank, the Gaza Strip, is under the absolute control of Israel, including the Gaza Strip from which Israel withdrew its forces and withdrew its settlers. It still controls it from without, the airspace, entry, exit, and so on.
Let me read some emails here. Here's Richard, who writes, Israel is a very rich, advanced country who happens blatantly to continue violating international law. What reason can there now logically be for the U.S. to continue to support Israel with loan guarantees and other aid to the tune of hundreds of millions of dollars per year? The United States is now energy independent. We no longer have the need to import any oil from the Middle East, so there is no longer any U.S. interest in spending resources to defend the Middle East. Israel and the Gulf states also very rich. Why should U.S. policy for the Middle East continue to be decided by OPEC? Since we don't need the Middle East oil anymore, the U.S. should leave Israel and the Arabs to fight their own battles. The sooner we leave the Middle East, the sooner the Israelis will have to reach an agreement with the Palestinians. It's a problem for the European energy consumers now, not for the United States. And let me read some critical remarks, Rashid Khalidi, and get your response to these. Gary writes on our website, please ask Dr. Khalidi how he reconciles the opinion that Israel creates the security problems it has with the historical timeline in which wars were declared on Israel from the start of its existence back in 1948. How can a cause follow an effect? That seems illogical.
Shall I take either or both of those?
Why don't you take both?
Let me take the second one first, and then I'll go back and talk about the United States lifting its hands from the Middle East. You know, the timeline is a lot more complicated than the questioner suggests. Long before the Arab armies first entered the Palestine Mandate on the 15th of May, about 300,000 or 400,000 Palestinians had been driven from their homes in a sort of civil war within Palestine after the United Nations partition resolution was passed in November 1947. The listener should read the history of that period because it set the pattern for everything that followed. When the Arab states intervened on May 15th, 1948, all of the major Palestinian inhabited cities had been emptied of most of their Palestinian population. Jaffa, Haifa, Bisan, Tiberias had all been basically ethnically cleansed, and large numbers of villages had also been emptied of their Arab population, as was West Jerusalem. All of this before May 15th. So you can argue that either of the two sides started the civil war, but there was no question who was winning the civil war in May. And then it's true the Arab armies did invade. And several of them were engaged in really serious combat with the state of Israel. But you should look carefully at what then happened. In 1956, it wasn't the Arabs who attacked Israel. It was Britain, France, and Israel that attacked Egypt. In 1967, the Egyptian army was threatening, but again, it was Israel that launched a preemptive war. 1973, the Arabs attacked Israel. 1982, there was a ceasefire for 11 months. I was living in Lebanon at the time. There was no pretext for the Israeli invasion. So all of these wars that you're talking about are not these wars of aggression launched on Israel with no pretext. It's much more complicated than that. And in any case, I was talking about the Palestinians in Israel. These are except 1982, these are Arab-Israeli wars. And they're relevant, obviously, to Israeli perceptions. They're relevant to our understanding of the history. But that's not actually what I was referring to. The first questioner, or the questioner who phoned in, asked why doesn't the United States just sort of abandon this and let the Arabs and Israelis fight it out. The oldest American connection in this region is actually antedates the connection with Israel. It antedates the establishment of Israel. It's the connection with Saudi Arabia going back to the oil deal that was signed with Ibn Saud, the founder of the modern Saudi state, in 1933. And I would be all for the United States understanding that it does not need to have this unique relationship with the autocracies of the the Arab autocracies of the Gulf region.
Which have been consistently, to some extent, using Palestinians as a political football.
And have built up much of the infrastructure that they had in the 50s, 60s, and 70s with Palestinian labor. These are countries which, as I try and show in the book, in particular Saudi Arabia, have consistently gone along with what the United States wanted on Palestine. Whatever they said publicly, using the Palestine issue as a political football, they have consistently been willing to bend to whatever American desiderata there were vis-a-vis Israel in the Palestine question. So I think it would be in the American national interest, it would be in the interest of the peoples of those countries if that relationship were loosened. And I frankly don't think anybody's security interests would be affected one way or another, not just because the United States is not dependent on that oil, but because whoever controls it has to sell it and it goes into the world market, and at that point it doesn't really matter. As far as Israel is concerned, there are a lot of people meeting in Washington right now, 14,000 of them, who are going to fight that idea tooth and nail. And I think that the special relationship has developed some quite perverse aspects to it between the United States and Israel. There are many, many reasons why the United States has connections with Israel. A lot of Americans feel strongly about it and so forth. But I would argue that most of the strategic justifications, some of which date back to the Cold War, some of which date back to the global war on terrorism, have really lost their force, and that the relationship should be examined much more coldly than it has been by most American politicians.
I'm getting a number of questions about the refugee return. it certainly seems to be at least part of this new framework for peace that Secretary Kerry has entered into. But a couple of questions coming in here by email. Phil says, is the guest in favor of treating the Jewish refugees from Arab countries in exactly the same manner as the Palestinian refugees with respect to reparations? And David says or asks, large U.S. populations used to live in Arab countries like Egypt and Syria. Are you aware of any Arab countries discussing willingness to allow Jews to return to their former homes in Arab countries? Many Arab countries won't even allow tourists who even have been to Israel to enter.
Yeah, I think it's actually a valid point. I don't think they can exactly be equated, but Arab countries forced, in many cases, their Jewish populations out and did not compensate them. And I think that's a scandal and a disgrace. And I think that those people should, if they desire, obviously have the right to go back. If they don't, they should certainly have the right to full reparations for their property. And I'm not aware of any Arab country that actually has offered anything like that. I mean, some countries like Morocco do allow Moroccan Jews not only to live there but also to come and go from Israel, so that there's a traffic back and forth. And some countries are better than that at that than others. Egypt, for example, anybody can go to Egypt, former Egyptian citizen of Jewish who is Jewish or anybody else. But I think that they're not quite the same in that I doubt that most Jewish refugees from Arab countries would want to go back, though I think they should have that right. Whereas the Palestinians, many of them perhaps are perfectly comfortable where they are, but many of them are not. And all of them certainly have a right if they so choose to be able to go back to their homeland and if possible to their homes. And all of them have the absolute right to their property, as do, I would argue, every single Jewish refugee from Arab countries, the right to their property, the right if they should choose to go back. And I think that is something that the Palestinians can and should push the Arab countries to do, not because it's a quid pro quo, but because it's the right thing to do.
More of your calls for Rashid Khalidi. Nancy, join us. You're on.
Oh, yes. Hi. It's kind of interesting. My husband and I were talking just about this very thing last night. And my feeling is that it's time for the United States to stop these fantasy negotiations with Kerry running back and forth and Obama having meetings with Bibi about, the rights of the Palestinians, because both the United States, I believe, and Israel have no idea whatsoever to let this happen. And I think we, the United States, needs to say honestly that Israel can do whatever they want and thumb their nose at us and everybody else because we, for some reason, need to have an ally in the Middle East. And if Obama and the United States government and Kerry were really interested in the Palestinian rights, they would say to Israel, okay, you've got to get rid of these settlements and you've got to have a positive attitude toward the Palestinians so that peace can be established, and whatever it is that the Palestinians need or want. And, you know, nobody's doing this. They're, you know, and it's time for an honest admittance of what's really going on.
Well, they may be doing it somewhat rhetorically without teeth. I mean, I think that's, Professor Khalidi, what you point out in your book to a great degree. It's been consistent, as you say, since acquiescence to what I would describe as a Menachem Begin paradigm going way back. But let me read another email here from a listener named Rick, who says, if the Israelis give the Palestinian statehood, maybe they will not be a security threat or something to that effect. Your guest seems to be saying, what rational leader would agree to the possibility of peace? Gaza is the perfect example. All Israel got was a neighborhood terrorist camp that rains rockets into Israel while killing their own citizens who do not agree with the terrorism that they foment.
Well, you know, Israel has a choice. Israel can just say, we're going to stay permanently in control of these people because we can't trust them to govern themselves. And I would be sort of relieved if that were the if that were admitted by I think that's what many Israelis believe. I think that's what Israelis have convinced many people in this country is the right course. This listener is certainly convinced of that. I doubt that he's spent a great deal of time there. And if he has, he's probably only seen one side of the issue. I think you should spend a few weeks in Gaza and he might see things a little bit differently. Or even a few weeks in the West Bank.
But President Obama said time is running out. I mean, he's made it very clear, and it may just be rhetorical, that permanent occupation of the West Bank and more restrictions on Palestinian movement is not going to be acceptable internationally.
He made that very clear to
Netanyahu, didn't he?
The time has run out. And I think that what the president and our government are really doing is running interference for Israel insofar as pressures from Europe and elsewhere are concerned, and also protecting the Arab regimes, which would be stark naked if the United States said what an earlier caller said and, in a sense, what the last questioner said. We're just going to leave the Israelis to do whatever they please. Governments like the government of Saudi Arabia would be left in a very difficult position. How can their people would say to them, how can you justify this alliance with the United States when the United States is basically giving the Israelis a free hand? When the United States can pretend to be shepherding a so-called peace process, these governments can at least say, well, you see, our friends, the Americans, are really trying to do something for the Palestinians. It would strip the veil off, in my view. It would be a very good thing.
Here's Colin joining us from San Francisco. Colin, you're on. Good morning.
Good morning, Professor. Isn't it true that Israel had obtained nuclear weapons through collaboration with the apartheid regime in South Africa and helped the South African regime obtain the atomic weapons in the 1970s? What did the U.S. government know about the Israeli-South African collaboration at the time, and did the Carter administration do anything to stop it or just merely give a wink and nod to the program?
The Israeli government got the technology and the reactor from the French, actually, in the 50s and the 60s. They got some of the fissile material, apparently, from South Africa. And they apparently tested a device together with the South Africans somewhere, either at sea or in the South African desert. So there was close collaboration between the two governments. Israel engaged in an elaborate deception of the United States during the Eisenhower and Kennedy administrations. In fact, they created a Potemkin part of the reactor at Dimona, which American inspectors were able to see while they were secretly engaged in weapons research and producing what apparently was a nuclear weapon already by 1967. There was this collaboration, and eventually the United States government found out. I believe it was during the Kennedy administration, and they were pretty unhappy. But by that point, there wasn't a whole lot they could do about it. It was French that were facilitating it, and it was South Africa, which was already – this was after Sharpeville, a rogue state and a state that was sort of out of control. And eventually there was a decision to just pretend that they didn't know. And Israel helped by never actually declaring that it had, as it has today, apparently about 200 or more.
They still have not declared.
They still have not declared. That's their policy. We will not be the first to use nuclear weapons.
Let me read another email here from a listener named Seth who says, it is disappointing that you chose to use valuable time and your guest applies his considerable intellect and knowledge toward advancing a one-sided view of the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. It is a tired effort to blame Israel alone rather than honestly acknowledging the responsibility of Palestinians for their own fate. Most importantly, it is a sad abandonment of a just solution for both peoples to live in peace and security in their own countries to which he could contribute substantially.
Let me say two things to your listeners. First of all, I think you should be very careful about blaming the victims. And secondly, if you're interested in my views on Palestinian responsibility, you should read a book of mine called The Iron Cage, which is essentially about Palestinian failures.
Which we talked about on forum and is in our
several generations of Palestinian.
I just want to mention it's available in our archives, I believe, our discussion
right,
of that
exactly.
book.
Exactly. Yeah. I think I was on your program, in fact.
I'm just giving it a listeners a heads up on that, that's all.
Well, thank you. But, you know, a lot depends on point of view and so forth. But if you really think that the Israelis are the victim in this conflict, then you and I have very little to say to one another. I think that there is a sense of victimization among Israelis that may have its roots in things that go back well before the Palestine issue. But that doesn't necessarily faithfully reflect the actual relationship between Israel and the Palestinians. And I think that you should go and spend time visiting the West Bank. I can't recommend anything as a better tonic for the kind of brainwashing, I have to put it that way, that a lot of people in this country have been subjected to.
Rashid Khalidi's new book is Brokers of Deceit, How the U.S. Has Undermined Peace in the Middle East. And Professor Khalidi, thank you for being with us.
It's a pleasure as always. Thank you for having me.
And we are here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, with an hour repeated in the evening, 10 to 11. We also remind you that you can continue this discussion online by going to our website, kqed.org/forum. And we always like to hear from you. You can email us, forum@kqed.org. We are produced by, that is, the people behind the scenes who produce this program, Judy Campbell and Irene Noguchi. And Amanda Stupai. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai, is what I meant to say. Danny Bringer is our producer, and our senior editor is Dan Zoll. And for all of us here at KQED Public Radio, again, thanks for being a part of this morning's program. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.